losing his religion today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. A young Iraqi tells us how ISIS destroyed his Christian faith.
When ISIS came, everybody believed in Christ. That's why I hid the crosses. Now, after they went, I dropped all religion, all the way.
Plus, all Sai Shoury ever wanted was to travel from his home in India to the U.S. to study computer science. But all that changed in a single moment.
That moment was when Trump was elected as President of the United States of America.
And a young high school student protected by DACA tells herself to keep fighting for the program despite calls to end it.
Don't lose hope. You've done so much. You've flown to D.C., you've flown to California, you've gone to so many protests. So something good will come of this.
Those stories and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for joining us today. Two forever wars. Looks like that might be where we're headed. We've already got one in Afghanistan, 16 years and counting. Now the U.S. may be going down the same road in Syria. Hold on to that thought. We'll come back to it in a few minutes. First, though, the ISIS caliphate may not be forever. The radical Islamists have lost most of their territory in Syria and northern Iraq. And residents of former ISIS-held regions are starting to pick up the pieces of their lives that ISIS shattered. The World's Richard Hall recently returned to the region himself and caught up with a teenager he first met a year ago. We'll call him Ibrahim to protect his identity. They met in Ibrahim's hometown of Bartella, Iraq, near Mosul.
We're driving through Bartella now, and there's the damage is just really hard to describe. Bullet holes everywhere, whole buildings are destroyed. It really feels like a ghost town. Ibrahim has been back in his hometown for just a few weeks now, but this is the first time he has really ventured out. These streets are full of bad memories for him.
I was walking through here. There was no one around. You could just hear the sound of dogs. That house was a Christian house. When ISIS came, they forced them to convert. When they escaped, we were the only ones left.
It's been almost a year since I saw Ibrahim last, in an office building full of displaced people in Erbil, some 40 miles away. Back then, he told me his Christian faith had got him through his time in captivity. He told me how he had hidden a small wooden cross he used to wear from his ISIS captors, and that he would one day go back to get it. But after his ordeal, he didn't go back to get the cross. In fact, he turned away from his faith altogether.
When ISIS came, and before that, everybody believed in Christ. That's why I hid the crosses. Now, after they went, I dropped all religion, all the way. I took it out of my mind.
I wondered how much of this was a teenager trying to discover his identity, or something else. I asked him to take me to the church where he used to pray. It's destroyed, like everything else, and the gate is locked.
So you sat in here for many hours when you were younger?
I always came here before anyone else. I was the first to come here. I used to sit alone, and I used to read for hours.
I asked Ibrahim if he would ever come back here.
I will come back, but I don't see this as a holy place.
On the way back to his house, Ibrahim says it was ISIS who led him away from his faith. He tells me that his traumatic time with the extremists and his forced conversion turned him away from all religion. I felt sad for Ibrahim that ISIS had changed him so dramatically. But I realized the more we talked that this was something more than Ibrahim losing his religion. He was finding something else. Back at his house, he shows me his bookshelf. He hands me books about religion and science. Then he points out a display he has made on his wall. Pictures of his favorite writers and thinkers that he has printed out. There's Richard Dawkins, the famous scientist, Karl Marx, Charles Darwin, Albert Einstein. During his time in captivity, Ibrahim developed an unquenchable thirst for knowledge, specifically for science. He was deprived for so long of learning that when he finally got out, he threw himself into it like never before. It's not far-fetched to see his transformation as a rejection of the extremist and unquestioning theism of the Islamic State that Ibrahim was forced to endure. His mother, Noor, still a practicing Christian, is not happy about his change.
I don't know what to do. I'm trying to convince him to come back to his religion because he was the best pupil. He was going to church every day, then coming home to pray. Since these devils came, he changed.
Before I leave, I drive through the main street and see that a few shops have reopened. It's going to be a long road to recovery for the town, but Ibrahim and his mother don't plan to be part of it. They hope to move to Canada with the help of a local charity. Ibrahim says he doesn't know much about Canada, just that it's very cold, and that it's a secular country that respects human rights. When I first met him after he escaped from ISIS, I asked him what he wanted to do with his life now he was free. Back then he said he didn't know. He couldn't imagine the future. But on this visit, he had an answer. He says, I know what I'm doing now. I want to be a scientist. For the World, Richard Hall in Bartella, northern Iraq.
From faith to faith, there are millions more such stories, of course, from the former ISIS territories. And life after ISIS in Iraq isn't just about rebuilding lives and cities. It's also about reclaiming the actual ground from the remnants of the war, which means dealing with landmines, unexploded IEDs, and booby traps. Iraqi forces retook Mosul last summer, but ISIS fighters had occupied the city for 3 years before that, and they left an unprecedented tangle of explosives.
I personally have never seen anything like Iraq when it comes to the density of contamination and the types of different improvised explosive devices that we see.
That's Per Lodhammer, head of the United Nations Mine Action Service in Iraq. When we spoke with him back in July, some experts estimated it could take a decade before Mosul was fully cleared of mines and booby traps. So we wanted to reach out to Lodhammer for an update. Thanks for being with us again. When was the most recent time you were in Mosul?
So I was in Mosul, in western Mosul, in the old city of Mosul, only 4 days ago.
Okay, so tell us what you saw. What is the situation? Just remind us of the scope of challenges you're facing, clearing mines and IEDs right now.
Yeah, so basically our focus right now is western Mosul and the old city of Mosul. And compared to what we saw in Ramadi and Fallujah, the contamination levels are much higher. Ammunition that we find and explosive remnants of war, it's including airdropped weapons and guided missiles, suicide belts, complex improvised explosive devices, and this mixed with debris and rubble. The level of rubble and debris from the fighting and from blown up buildings, it's so high. And we estimate that we find about a third of the ammunition on the surface, and at least two-thirds of the ammunition will actually be under the ground, sometimes very deep. The scope is so complex. Our teams are going to one location to deal with one piece of explosives. And in going there, that community will report another five explosive hazards in the area.
So when we last spoke with you over the summer, your teams had a list of 255 different jobs, mostly clearing critical infrastructure. So how is that actually going? How have things changed since then?
Yeah, so that list is changing on a weekly basis. We get more tasks, we complete some tasks, so it's changing. But what is important is that we work in order of priority. So the old city of Mosul, it has eight different main districts. And right now we worked and completed five of these districts. And what we find is that in all the streets, all the infrastructure and all the districts, there is explosive hazards. Again, as I said the last time, we are supporting United Nations development programs and the government of Iraq in their stabilization efforts. So everything we still do, it's critical infrastructure. But also in doing this in the old city, we are finding people are returning to collect their belongings. And as they are returning, they're also finding explosive hazards in their houses, in their homes. And I mean, that is all our work is about. It is about getting people back to their homes. And that's what's driving myself and my staff every day.
So that previous estimate of possibly nearly a decade before Mosul is cleared, does that estimate still hold up? Like, when will you feel confident that people can just move back to these neighborhoods?
I can't give a date and a time for that, but I believe that the estimate still holds. It is going to be a significant period until everything has been cleared. But still, there is light in the end of the tunnel. You will see that markets are open, people are selling fish. It's cold here right now. Also, people are selling heaters, people are repairing heaters. The Iraqi people are incredibly resilient, and we see that they open up little shops, and it's much more lively now, obviously, than it was before. And I was in Mosul in early December, and then I was back again now 4 days ago. And only during that time, I've seen a big difference. I've seen that the streets are being cleared. We're finding a lot of explosives. Every piece that we're removing is, of course, important. And considering that we only gained entrance to Western Mosul and the old city in November, I think there's been massive progress.
Per Lodhammer, head of the United Nations Mine Action Service in Iraq, thanks very much for your work and the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Some analysts suggest that ISIS emerged as a result of the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq in 2011. Now, that's debatable, but the Trump administration is now saying the U.S. will not make the same mistake in Syria. Here's Secretary of State Rex Tillerson speaking yesterday at Stanford University.
Let us be clear. The United States will maintain a military presence in Syria focused on ensuring ISIS cannot reemerge.
And he said those U.S. troops will remain there until conditions are right for them to leave. Tillerson's speech was actually a huge step forward in clarifying U.S. policy in Syria. For example, he made plain that the U.S. is committed once again to removing Bashar al-Assad from power and ending what he called malicious Iranian influence in Syria, in addition to containing ISIS. To meet these ends, Tillerson said, is bolstering local forces like the Kurds so they can hold on to their territory in northern Syria. Josh Landis is professor of international studies at the University of Oklahoma. So let's take this apart one piece at a time, starting with the U.S. military presence. There was one veteran who tweeted this morning, I'm assuming this was a joke, "Good news, Syria officially joins a forever war family," 3 exclamation points. So, I mean, is that right, Josh?
Well, a lot of people are worried that it is, because if you build up the Kurds in northern Syria, they own about 25% to 30% of Syrian territory today with the help of the United States. They don't have an air force. They're very poor. Many of their cities are broken down. You want to build them into an enduring country, I suppose, or part autonomous region. Turkey does not want this. Syria does not want it. Both of them are sworn to dismantling it. How can the United States leave unless it's willing at some further date to allow the edifice that they're building to collapse and be overrun?
So how much danger do these U.S. troops face now?
The troops don't face a lot of danger because it's unlikely that they're going to be attacked while America is there. I don't think either Turkey or Assad wants to go to war against U.S. troops. The problem is that they're going to be there for a long time to bolster and overfly northern Syria until, theoretically, Assad has gone and Iran is rolled back. And those two conditions don't look like they're on the horizon in any way, shape, or form. So this is a formula for an enduring American presence in Syria.
Maybe I'm not getting a clear answer because that's part of the policy, but if you had one sentence, how would you characterize the goal of this policy?
The goal is to hurt Russia and Iran. That's the goal, is to keep Assad weak and the region divided.
And why do you think this force posture announcement came from the State Department and not from the Pentagon?
Well, the Pentagon has been implying some of these things, but Tillerson is being put out front, you're right, to, in a sense, clarify this new policy that is a very un-Trumpian policy. Today, we've gone back to the older policy, which is regime change, democracy promotion, and America can fix the Middle East.
All right. Leads me to my last question. On a scale of 1 to 10, how close is this U.S.-Syria policy to President Obama's?
Many of the talking points are the same. The objectives are the same.
Sounds like an 8 or 8.5 if you take away the difference of political parties.
It's about an 8.5.
Josh Landis, professor of international studies at the University of Oklahoma, speaking with us from Arezzo, Italy, where he's working this year. Josh, thanks as always.
Great pleasure.
Should Steve Bannon be able to invoke executive privilege? Congressman Adam Schiff weighs in, coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World.
I think we've been dealing with this hoax for the better part of a year. If we have to endure the ridiculousness for another month, we can certainly handle it. Do the American people deserve that? No, I don't think they do.
White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders there. The hoax she's alleging is the possibility that the Trump campaign colluded with Russia to interfere in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. If it is a hoax, then why was Steve Bannon so uncooperative about answering questions about the Russia connection from the House Intelligence Committee on Tuesday?
He told us, basically, he was under instructions from the White House not to answer our questions.
That's California Representative Adam Schiff, the top Democrat on the committee. He says the former top strategist for Trump was effectively under a White House gag order during his testimony.
His lawyer was in communication in real time with White House counsel, and he was being instructed to tell his client not to answer those questions. So when the administration would later go on TV, as they did yesterday with Secretary Kelly, and say, we never told Steve Bannon to invoke the executive privilege, technically, that's correct, but it's also very misleading because they did tell him not to answer those questions.
So is Bannon not answering questions? Is that acceptable for your committee?
Not at all. And we're going to have to insist that he answer. We're going to have to go to court if necessary, but not just with respect to Mr. Bannon, because the very next day, Corey Lewandowski came into our committee and I think followed Mr. Bannon's example and said, I won't answer questions after I left the campaign.
So in response to those non-answers, the committee chair, Representative Devin Nunes, a Republican, also from California, issued a subpoena for Mr. Bannon. So if Bannon returns for another appearance, do you expect more cooperation?
I expect, in fact, there will be more cooperation because I think the White House position is unsustainable and the majority seems ready to enforce his compliance. I hope they'll show some consistency, though, and also require Mr. Lewandowski to answer the same questions. It is, I think, very hard for the majority to explain why they're treating Mr. Bannon differently. Clearly, they have some concerns about what Mr. Bannon might say.
Will there be more subpoenas coming for Corey Lewandowski and any others who don't answer questions?
I would hope so. But again, the majority has been very selective about when it wants to enforce compliance with the investigation. In that way, I think we've been very ill-served because it's left a lot of questions unanswered. For example, the Attorney General came before our committee and said, when I asked him, have you ever been instructed to take any action that you believe would hinder the Russia investigation? He refused to answer. And the majority not only declined to subpoena him, but seems perfectly copacetic getting that answer from the Attorney General. And that, to me, is remarkable that the Congress of the United States wouldn't insist on knowing whether the Attorney General was under instructions to hinder the Russia investigation.
It feels like there's a renewed energy with the committee. Is it just a new year, or is there a reason for this sudden flurry of appearances before the Intelligence Committee right now?
The majority is very opaque about what they're doing and why they're doing it. So we don't know what suddenly spurred them to invite Steve Bannon in, for example. We have been asking that Steve Bannon come in and testify for months. So why all of a sudden now, and why all of a sudden show this determination to get this witness to answer questions when they seem to allow other witnesses to walk all over them? I don't know the answer to that. Is this merely because Steve Bannon at the moment seems to be a man without a country, rejected by the White House, no longer at Breitbart? Do the majority members feel empowered because he's not at Breitbart anymore and therefore is not in a position to use that platform to speak out? I really can't say because the majority has decided to conduct itself in a very unilateral way. It doesn't let us know who they're bringing in or when, but we get minimal notice of these things.
So if the Republicans are getting just as aggressive as the Democrats in opposing these claims of executive privilege, isn't this an about-face on the Russia investigation? Because, haven't the Republicans basically been trying to kill the investigation?
I wouldn't, declare this an about-face as a general matter. It's only an about-face vis-a-vis one witness, Steve Bannon, who appears to be on everybody's list at the moment. They're not bringing the Attorney General back to answer the questions he refused to answer. They're not bringing Don Jr. back at this point to get him to answer the questions he refused to answer. He was asked about his conversation with his father that led to that false statement about the Trump Tower meeting, and he refused to answer, asserting attorney-client privilege when neither he nor his father is an attorney or client here.
California Representative Adam Schiff, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let me tell you now about the death of a Serbian politician from Kosovo. His name was Oliver Ivanovic. He's someone we used to hear from on the show back when Kosovo was regularly in the news after the U.S. led a NATO intervention in 1999. 2 days ago, Ivanovic was gunned down on his way to work in Mitrovica, That's a city in Kosovo that's divided between the Serb minority in the north and the Albanian majority in the south. It's still a tense place 19 years after the war in Kosovo. Valerie Hopkins is a journalist who covers the Balkans, and she says Ivanovic was considered a moderate Serbian voice in Kosovo, someone who called for dialogue.
He's much beloved by the foreign diplomats, foreign journalists, and many political figures in Kosovo who, you know, say that he was a man who it was very easy to make compromises with, that he was very flexible, that he understood that actually Kosovo Serbs and Kosovo Albanians were not that different from one another, were very similar in mindset, but that it was outside forces that divided them.
That's not to say that Ivanovic recognized Kosovo's independence from Serbia. He didn't. He was also convicted of war crimes against ethnic Albanians. The conviction was overturned last year, but he was facing retrial when he was killed. So Kosovo Albanians had mixed feelings about him.
You know, some people see the conviction, even though it was overturned, for war crimes as evidence that, you know, he really wasn't as good as everyone says. Mm. Other people see the fact that he was so willing to negotiate, that he was flexible, that he spoke not only very good English, but also very good Albanian, which is something that many, many Serbs in Kosovo cannot do, even though 90% of the population is ethnic Albanian. You know, that was seen really as an effort to get to know the majority population in the country in which he now lived.
Ivanovic didn't start out wanting to be a politician. As a kid, he hoped to be a pilot.
But unfortunately, he was unable to do that, I think because of his eyesight. So he turned to karate instead. And he eventually became a black belt. And that's really what catapulted him into politics.
He began training young Serbian nationalists to guard a bridge over the river to prevent Albanians from coming to the Serbian side of Mitrovica.
It was through training these so-called bridge watchers that he really rose to political prominence and launched his career as an independent candidate.
There's no word yet who was responsible for Ivanovic's daylight murder, but it happened the same day that Serbia and Kosovo were scheduled to resume talks on normalizing relations. They've since been suspended. I'm Marco Werman. Cape Town, South Africa is running out of water and residents are asking questions.
Did the future come early? Is this the new normal? Is this actually a transition into a new climatic regime? Or is it another drought?
How the city is preparing for this April with maybe zero water. That's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. President Trump says he did not try to slam the door on immigrants from Haiti in that controversial meeting at the White House last week. Others who were there say he did. But whatever was said then, this week the Trump administration did shut at least one door to Haitians. The Department of Homeland Security said yesterday that Haitians would no longer be eligible for temporary visas known as H-2A and H-2B. Those are visas for seasonal work on farms and in other industries. Belize and Samoa were also banned from the programs. I asked Muzaffar Shishti of the Migration Policy Institute why DHS made this shift.
With respect to Samoa, they say that Samoa has not been cooperating with the government, with our U.S. government, in accepting people who have final orders of removal in the United States. With respect to Belize, the argument is that Belize has not been cooperating with the U.S. in terms of trying to control trafficking of immigrants in the United States.
And Haiti?
With respect to Haiti, it's saying that that Haiti has sent a large number of people who overstayed their visa.
So do you know whether there is a kind of a set of rules that DHS uses to decide which countries to remove from the list when they revise it? Because this sounds like it's almost punishing countries for bad behavior.
Well, I mean, it's either punishing countries for bad behavior or using certain leverage in our immigration law to make them to behave in a certain way. The interesting thing about this set is that the Trump administration is using every tool in the toolbox that it can find to make countries behave in the way that it wants. In that regard, it's sort of unprecedented.
So let's set aside Samoa and Belize for the moment and look at Trump's recent record on Haiti, because there was his reported use of that word to describe Haiti last week. And also, before that, Trump stopped temporary protected status for Haitians. Could it be this announcement from DHS is coincidental, or do you believe Trump has it in for Haiti and its people?
You know, that's the interesting thing about our present narrative on immigration. Normally, these kind of changes, which you would say are sort of normal tweaking and reassessment of our immigration policy, would go unnoticed. But that's in the usual times in immigration. We are not in the usual times in immigration. That's why everything that this administration does on immigration gets highly analyzed, and everything is under the microscope. And with regard to Haiti particularly, this is an extraordinarily unfortunate timing. The administration has decided to terminate the temporary protected status for Haiti at a time when Haiti is still unstable. So that already sent a message that Haitians were treated differently. Then the language that the president used last week in terms of describing Haiti or Haitians has added to the narrative that it is sending a certain message to the community as if they are not at par with the rest of the civilized world. And to add this termination of Haiti in the H-2A and H-2B programs just adds to that narrative.
Do you know if Haitians typically overstay their H-2A, H-2B visas?
The analysis done by DHS is that Haitians on the whole have overstayed their visas by close to 39%. That is high, but we have also looked at the overstay rates of some other countries, which are not as high as 39, but in the high 20s, and they have not been taken off the list. So that also is going to get noticed.
So how dependent are Haitians on the H-2A and B visas? Like, if you close these off, what's the result for Haitians, do you think?
In reality, it's a very small number of people. But in the magnified reality of immigration politics, it sends a huge message.
So with a small number of people, will there be a large economic impact to U.S. business once these countries are barred from coming here and doing this unskilled labor?
The numbers are so small that I think, frankly, the dent on the U.S. economy is going to be felt in pockets, but in the main, very minimal.
Muzaffar Shishti with the Migration Policy Institute, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, new restrictions for some potential immigrants to the U.S. Other folks, it seems, just might not want to come here these days. The Commerce Department reports that tourist visits to the U.S. were down 4% in the first half of last year, even as they grew in other countries. Now there's word of a big drop in international graduate students in science and engineering in the U.S., down 6%. The governing board of the National Science Foundation says that's after steady increases over roughly the past decade. The World's Carolyn Beeler tracked down one student from India who may well add to the trend.
When Sai Shori was growing up in Hyderabad, his aunts and uncles and cousins living in the U.S. used to come back for visits. They brought suitcases full of gifts and stories of a land of plenty in America.
They used to say that U.S. is like this, U.S. is like that. You can have a very comfortable life over there. And the job opportunities are very, very good.
By the time he was 12 years old, Shori was convinced.
Since my childhood, I have dreams of U.S., studying in U.S. as well as getting settled in U.S.
4 years ago, Shori enrolled in an IT program, specifically so that he'd be competitive for a computer science master's program in the U.S. But his plans changed in a single moment in the fall of 2016.
To be frank, that moment was when Trump was elected.
Shori had followed President Trump's America First campaign platform and his promises to restrict immigration.
When he used to say that, we used to believe that if he really gets to be the president of United States of America, then we might have a tougher situation at the time.
Shori and a handful of Indian students I interviewed worried about two main things. First, paying for an expensive U.S. master's degree, and then not being able to get a job in the U.S. if visas were restricted.
What if I don't get a job? That's my question. And the second thing is, what if I get attacked by some random guy?
Shori had heard about anti-immigrant violence in the U.S., like how two Indian men were shot in a Kansas City bar last February. This was enough to make Shori ditch the dream he'd held for nearly a decade to get his master's degree in the U.S.
You're shattered for some time. For a couple of days, I was like totally aimless.
Shattered, but not alone. In 2017, the U.S. saw its first drop in international enrollment in science and engineering grad programs since 2005. Almost all that decrease comes in two fields, computer science and engineering. And that's while the need for workers in those fields is soaring, especially in Silicon Valley.
There is an insatiable demand.
This is Michael Morell, who runs the tech recruiting firm Riviera Partners.
There's more jobs than we can fill with the current slate of talent.
More than half the tech workers in Silicon Valley are foreign-born, and those jobs are being fed in part by U.S. grad programs.
Over 50% of our graduate students in technical areas are from outside the country.
This is Jerry Richmond, a chemistry professor who oversaw the new NSF report. U.S.-born science and engineering grad students started declining a decade ago. So recruiting international students has been vital to keeping program numbers up.
We have a research engine that needs to be fueled, and that fuel is really our graduate students. And so as we continue to try to attract the best and brightest in our country, we also seek to attract the best and brightest from these other countries.
The report doesn't delve into political factors that might be influencing international students, but Richmond points to high costs and increasing competition from China as possible causes of dropping enrollment in the U.S. Meanwhile, other countries are capitalizing on it. Australian universities have seen an international enrollment bump, and Canada.
This is a moment for Canada to shine.
This is Paul Davidson from Universities Canada, which represents nearly 100 institutions across the country.
We have seen an 11% increase in international enrollment at Canadian universities over the last year. We first started to see the increases of interest expressed after Brexit.
And then came the Trump administration's January 2017 travel ban.
The weekend that that happened, my iPhone was absolutely dancing across the table because the world wants to find an alternative.
That alternative caught Cy Shorey's eye when he was researching graduate school options outside the U.S.
I was reading about that country and I fall in love. I used to chat with random people who are from Canada. They don't mind which country you're from, what's your financial status, how do you talk. They don't care about any of those things.
That rosy view of Canada was reinforced by what Shorey saw on the news.
You can see the Prime Minister, how he's accepting the Syrian refugees, going to the airport, receiving one by one, hugging each other. And you can see Mr. Trump. You can see a contrast between them, right?
Shorey has five applications in for computer science programs in Canada and hopes to start at one of them in September. He still wants to work at a big tech company like Google, just in their Canadian office. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Let's turn now to one of those who's already in the U.S. and wants to stay here. She's an undocumented high school student who has temporary legal status under DACA. That's the Obama-era program that's at the center of the immigration battle in Washington right now. We're hearing this week from a number of DACA recipients in our DACA Diary series. The World's Monica Campbell has today's story.
My name is Indira Nicole Marquez Robles. I am 18 years old, and I live in Northwest Houston, Texas.
Her home since she was a baby.
I was 6 months old when I was brought to the United States.
From Mexico. One by one, Indira's relatives, her dad, grandmother, aunts, and uncles, had migrated north for work. Then it was time for Indira and her mom to go. The plan was to meet a woman at a bus stop near the Texas border.
My grandmother had a few contacts, and she found this woman that had like the passport for a little baby girl. And so she was going to cross me over as that baby girl.
Indira on the bus in a stranger's arms while her mom swam across the river.
I believe my mom did that because she wanted to take the best chances. She just felt that she had to take that risk because it would pay off in the end. She put a lot of hope into being able to meet me once we're both made it into the United States.
Today, Indira is a high school senior with typical teenage worries, nervous about going away for college, being far from her mom, brothers and sisters, their two parakeets. Then came President Trump's decision to end DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. He called it illegal, an overreach that rewards lawbreakers. Indira got DACA status in 2016 when she turned 15.
When someone asks me what DACA means to me, what it's done for me, I say that I've been recognized as someone that exists in the United States, and it gives me somewhere to flourish.
It opened the door to scholarships, financial aid, a work permit. Its end meant Indira's DACA status would expire in March.
It's also disheartening because, you know, it throws us back into like a land of the unknown.
Last week, a court blocked Trump's move to end DACA. The judge said the decision to end it was arbitrary. Indira now hopes her DACA status will last longer, but nothing seems certain. The Trump administration is fighting back, asking the Supreme Court to intervene. Even if Indira does get some relief, she also knows plenty of undocumented people being left behind, like her mom, with little chance of getting papers anytime soon.
It's like putting a Band-Aid on a much bigger wound.
It motivates Indira to get more active, organize with other students. She tells herself there'll be a payoff.
Don't lose hope. You've done so much. You've flown to D.C. You've flown to California. You've gone to so many protests. So something good will come of this.
One good thing for her would be to complete college without getting deported. Go to law school. Become an immigration lawyer. Her dream.
Especially because people were like, you can't be an immigration lawyer. You have DACA. They don't even give you the chance to pass your bar exam. And then I read about the people that did it anyways, and I wanted to be like them.
She says when she wants to feel less discouraged, she talks to her mom about the risks she took. She says she's in awe hearing how her mom handed her as a baby to that woman she barely knew on the bus, trusting her to take her across the border.
She'll talk about like how it felt, how hot it was, what the wind was like. And I love hearing these stories because they're actual experiences of her. So she and I sort of use it as like a coping method with like, whether it be the political climate or whether like there's a strain like at home or something. It helps me a lot. And it's honestly inspiring to hear like what my mom's done.
Indira says talks like this help when she sees and hears people who want her gone, out of America.
While we were marching in our bright orange shirts throughout downtown, people had said, you don't deserve to be here. You should go back. You don't deserve having the American lifestyle. It's not the negativity that brings me down. I obviously don't like it. It just lets me know that society is still very tender and doesn't know where to stand on immigration, and we have to learn together where we have to be in the future.
Indira Nicole Marquez Robles there, speaking with The World's Monica Campbell. It's part of DACA Diaries, our series on undocumented students and how they're navigating their future in the U.S. We'd love to hear your thoughts. What reforms do you think should be made to the DACA program, and how? Go to PRI's Facebook page and tell us what you think. They're calling it Day Zero in Cape Town, South Africa. That's the day the taps could run dry in people's homes after 3 years of low rainfall. It's gotten so bad that the city now expects to run out of water on April 21st. That would mean residents could only get water from government distribution centers. Christine Colvin is a senior manager of the World Wildlife Fund's freshwater program in South Africa. She says cutting back has so far been difficult for residents.
I think the population is quite divided in terms of, you know, there are people who are really concerned about water saving, who are following the city's dashboard, you know, on a weekly basis to see what level our dams are at and how much water we're using as a city. But clearly, there's still a majority of people in the city who are not adequately concerned because we're not hitting the targets and people are not able to stay within their 87 liters per person per day, which is the current limit that's been set by the city. And as a consequence of not meeting that target and the low levels of storage in our dams, at the moment, our dams are at only 28% full.
Wow.
There are six major dams that feed Cape Town, the surrounding farms and agricultural areas, and the other smaller towns. So we're all dependent on this one system, and this one system is running dry.
So people who are trying to adapt, what are they doing? What kind of changes are they facing in daily routines?
Well, we are told to limit our showers to 1.5 minutes. So I, for one, have had to cut my hair a bit shorter because that wasn't long enough to wash my hair when it was a bit longer. Baths are a complete no-no. Watering your garden is also not allowed. Topping up your swimming pool is not allowed. So within your 87 liters per person per day, you're allowed to have short showers. Most people are then reusing that shower water to flush the toilets. We're trying to limit the amount of laundry that we're doing. So now you're hanging your clothes out to air and just doing one load a week. People are just, you know, really trying to reuse every drop they can.
How does this drought play out in Cape Town differently if you live, say, like in an affluent gated community or if you're not that well off?
I think if you're in an affluent household and suburb, then it's more likely that you've got access to alternative sources of water. Cape Town is really lucky in that it has some major aquifer systems and groundwater resources within the city itself, as well as surrounding the city. And if you can afford to, you can either sink in a well point or a borehole to access that groundwater. Mm. In addition, wealthier households are able to afford rainwater harvesting tanks, and a lot of people have rigged up their gutters to feed rainwater from their rooftops into these tanks. So a big difference is that, you know, money brings you more ways to diversify your own water sources, which come day zero is going to be really important. After day zero, it's only going to come from communal points of distribution, and each person is allowed a maximum of 25 liters per day. Wow. So in the poorer neighborhoods, people are not going to have access to alternatives. They're going to be forced to join those queues and access water in that way.
Why is this drought happening, Christine?
In terms of looking at the longer term trends, what's really interesting is that the climate change projections have for many years now predicted that the area that Cape Town is in will get much drier and a bit hotter as climate change progresses. And of course, the big debate is, did the future come early? Is this the new normal? Is this actually a transition into a new climatic regime, which is influenced by climate change? Or is it another drought? Because obviously we've also historically had drought periods as well. You know, there's frustration against the authorities because people feel that with the growing population in Cape Town and the Western Cape, the national and regional authorities have known from the scientists that in all likelihood, the future is going to be much drier. So we need to make even more contingency for storing water and for using different sources of water. Those plans have been on the table for a long time, at least the last 15 years, but it's really only now that they're being prioritized and implemented.
I mean, day zero is such an ominous proposition, this kind of day on which water runs out. What kind of mood has that created in Cape Town? I mean, how worried are residents that you will get to day zero?
It's so interesting because the people who are really saving and who've really sort of done their reading on day zero are very anxious and very concerned. And yet there's pretty much half of our population who seem to be in denial about it and about the potential reality of that. That's one of the reasons why at WWF, we've seen the data, we've seen the evidence that day zero is coming, and we want to add our voice to the voices that are out there to say, this is real, this is coming. There are some very practical things that Cape Townians need to start doing sooner rather than later to get ready for this really disruptive and difficult situation that we're about to experience.
Christine Colvin, the senior manager for the World Wildlife Fund South Africa's freshwater program. Thank you very much and good luck.
Thank you.
Finally today, the final chapter in the story of an American song that unexpectedly shot to number one around the world. The last chapter is about the death of the man who made it happen. But let's start with the chapter in the middle of the story. Really wanna see. George Harrison thought a lot about God back in the day. Krishna, he'd have said. A lot of other people were doing the same. When Harrison recorded My Sweet Lord in 1970, the musical Godspell was about to have its first performance on Broadway. Jesus Christ Superstar would premiere a year later, and the concept of born again was a thing thanks to the growing evangelical movement. and an older song, a gospel and R&B number, was so central in this awakening, if you will, that George Harrison said it inspired him to write My Sweet Lord.
Oh, happy day.
Oh, happy day.
Oh, a happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Oh, Happy Day by the Edwin Hawkins Singers. Rewind to chapter one. Edwin Hawkins was studying interior design at UC Berkeley when he formed the Northern California State Choir at a local church. Hawkins built a new arrangement of an 18th century hymn, the chorus recorded it, and it became a hit. Number one in France and Germany, number two in the UK, and number four on the charts here in the US. It is the thing that Edwin Hawkins will be most remembered for. He died this week at the age of 74. But, oh, that song.
Oh, happy day.
Oh, happy day.
We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.